One of the fantastic things about doing cosmology now is that we have data to work with, and once data comes in, you've got to work within that. And one important data set that I think we all should respect is this one. How many people know what this photo is about? So this is the Hubble servicing mission, and this is the interior of the space shuttle, and that's the Hubble telescope out the window. And this is a ball used by Edwin Hubble to win a basketball championship when he was an undergraduate at the University of Chicago. And there's actually a really sweet story about, if you stare at this long enough, you realize it's a different ball. But he did, it's a sweet story about how, as far as I know, this was actually contraband on the shuttle. It was not officially sanctioned by NASA, but an astronaut who was also an alum of University of Chicago had a sentimental feeling about that, and Rocky Kolb helped acquire this ball out of a glass case at the University of Chicago. So Rocky told me the story. I loved it. And then he emailed me this photo, and I said, well, I love the story, I love the photo, but it bothers me because it's clearly evidence against inflation. And you just don't mess with Rocky Kolb. So the email comes right back. He says, no, it's just evidence against eternal inflation. So evidence is evidence. And so I'm going to consider alternatives to eternal inflation. On a more serious note, to start with, it's clear we're doing amazingly ambitious. We're all incredibly ambitious. We're trying to understand the whole universe. We're far from doing it. And my point of view with these things, and I think it's probably how we're all thinking in one way or another, we're trying to understand the whole universe. And the things we're trying to, the mechanisms we're hoping to use to understand it, depend on fundamental physics in a way that we're not sure the fundamental physics actually works that way. So we're speculating in parallel about how the fundamental physics works. And so I think, and so on a bad day, you could say, well, let's figure out the fundamental physics, and then we'll know how cosmology works. Most days, I think, well, we have some really interesting hints in cosmology is what fundamental physics has to ultimately explain. And so I think our best hope is that we, by trying to make cosmology work, we actually come up with something equivalent to the Bohr atom. The Bohr atom wasn't quantum theory, but it was trying, using the fact we know that atoms are stable to try to inch our way forward to some more fundamental understanding. And I think that's what we're all doing in some sense, is trying to see what we need the fundamental physics to do to get cosmology right, and hopefully that brings us some insights and we can sort of iterate our way to a deeper understanding. And certainly how I see what I'm doing. So I'm going to start. Oh, this is nice. You know that Google wants to synchronize my calendar, even though I don't know how to shut that thing off. So the organization of my talk is four sections. I want to start. I think one of the curious things about working in this field is that we all have all kinds of intuitions and instincts, and a lot of them are based in everyday physics. And it's interesting to see how some can extend and some maybe not to cosmology. And I think one of the exercises is to, first of all, reveal to each other what we're assuming, how we're thinking, and also challenge each other whether these extrapolations we do of our intuition to the whole universe are valid. So I just want to put some comments on the board, sort of reveal the ideas and principles that influence me, and maybe say some provocative things along the way. I love having questions throughout my talk. But these are topics where, to get to really get going with them, it'll have to be in the discussion, you know, over coffee and stuff. And we've had some great discussions already. So, first, some comments about initial conditions. So, the inflation hope was that we could depend less on initial conditions than we might have thought. And it's not clear how many people, I mean, in the early days of inflation, that was the exciting thing about inflation. And it's not clear how much we all are following that hope these days, but at least some of us are. Now, suppose we say, I don't think there's any hope of reducing our dependence on initial conditions, then I would say the competition for all our great theories is a simple one. The competition is just the standard Big Bang with the right state, no inflation, with the right state at T equals epsilon, right after the singularity. So we just plug in the right state, no inflation, and that's what we have. And so I think this is elegant, it's conservative, and so if we're doing something more than that, we want to know why it's better than this. And there's lots of reasons it might be, but that's good to keep that in mind. Another point to make about initial conditions is the second law. The second law tells us that the entropy had to be smaller in the past. To be smaller in the past, the entropy smaller means in a more limited part of phase space. And so it seems unavoidable that if the second law is true and the entropy is low in the past, then the early universe is weird in some sense. It's unnatural. So I tend to be very resistant about anthropics overall, but the one topic, one anthropic point of view where I'm a total pushover is the belief that you cannot have life of any sort, unimagined, imagined, whatever, without a second law. It would be really fun to be challenged on this, but this is a very strong belief of mine. And so we might have a choice between having a second law and therefore existing and scratching our heads about the initial conditions of the universe, or having natural initial conditions of the universe and not having a second law. So this may be a real difficult choice here. And then a related topic is the past hypothesis. And this is basically, another way to say it is, we don't just have a little second law, we have a whole lot of second law in the universe. And along the way, with these topics comes the question, once you start thinking about the phase space and wondering why we're here and not there, then Boltzmann brains become an issue as well. So the next point is that if you walk down the halls of a physics department and ask who cares about initial conditions when they do a calculation, it's only in the cosmology corner that people do. People normally, I'm sorry? Oh, the past hypothesis says that if we extrapolate backwards from the current state, we assume the entropy is lower. Whereas if you just did state counting, you could take the most general microstate consistent with what is around us, and the most general microstate would have a higher entropy in the past. So the past hypothesis is a belief we have about the universe, and it seems, well, it's the belief that we're not a Boltzmann universe, basically. And that's what we all believe that. The past hypothesis? Oh, I'll get to that. Yeah, I tend to think the arrow of time can be double-headed. So really, my personal view of this stuff is that there is a fluctuation and there's a minimum entropy and there's a second law going both ways out of that. But it's still problematic because it seems unnatural to have the fluctuation so big as in our universe. So no one else cares about initial conditions. Sorry? Yes. Yeah. It's a fundamental difference. I think if we try to understand cosmology, we're stuck with this problem. But it's not well. Or we just set them, right? Biologists do, yeah. So they care about initial conditions. Some do, I suppose. Yeah, so there, I would say that's a cosmological type of problem that they're when they do that. So, no one in quotes for the people who want to deconstruct that. Now, I think so hovering on this list is this idea that maybe we just have to also set initial conditions just like everyone else. Maybe I got it wrong, but the message I got from Jim's talk was that that's sort of how you were thinking, is we have to set initial conditions. That's part of the project, and that we don't really get to escape that in any necessarily significant way. And actually, I would say I have the same question for people who are thinking about eternal inflation and thinking about a census taker's hat, for example, where at late times we have this Minkowski space with stuff just going off to infinity. And I can ask, what is the very beginning of that universe like? And at least some people will tell me, well, it's kind of like that. It's like a Minkowski space with stuff coming in. And if that's the case, and the idea is that all the stuff going out is contains all the information about the whole universe, then the stuff coming in has to as well, if it's unitary. And I think maybe I've got that wrong, but that's a question for the census taker people. What are they really thinking about initial conditions, and are they realizing this hope in some way or not? That's just a question I have. But I'm not going to give up my talk time for you to answer. It's okay. I figure since I'm giving a talk in the theater of ideas, I should put some ideas. So the one exception about no one else caring, the one exception I want to put on the board, is equilibrium. So everyone thinks they can predict the state of a system if it comes into equilibrium. And they do it. You know, it's one of our great tools in physics and other fields. And then the last point is just a pet peeve of mine. It seems that a lot of cosmologists are deep in some grand meta picture of cosmology. And they say, So we start at very large density. Now, the only reason you can say that is because you've been trained on the Big Bang, and you know the Big Bang starts at high density. We have no idea if some meta picture of the universe starts at high density. So I put no entitlement. It's just being provincial in the technical sense. Okay, now I want, so that's ideas and principles. I'm happy to take comments and questions or be harassed over coffee and lunch. So, for example, people seem to think that it's obvious in the string theory landscape that I start at the high potential. No, in the meta picture. So. In this cosmos, but if we want to explain why our universe is like it is, we need some meta picture, and in the meta picture, we don't necessarily get to assume you start up. It depends on what you're doing about this. And that's an example of where you don't assume it's high. You derive that it gets high in some way. Well, I don't know what it, I'm just saying. I'm saying if you're trying to make a general statement, you just gotta. Right, but if you're just gonna plug in experimental evidence, I can just go with this, and we can all go home. But I think if we're trying to make a compelling meta picture, we need to explain what we start with and how much of it we're explaining with dynamics, like inflation, like a landscape, or so something that includes physics beyond the universe we see around us. So something that explains how the Big Bang got started, why it was more probable to be one way or another. Why we're not a Boltzmann brain. If we have some larger theory which is trying to answer some of those questions, in that larger theory, I don't think we're entitled just to choose a large row. I mean, maybe if we can do it if we're doing this, if we're doing some. Yes, but it works really. I would. If you want to say, I like to start with high rho, and that's just an assumption, and then here's the other beautiful things about my theory, I might appreciate those beautiful things and share the joy with you, I would say that a large rho might just be an assumption, and since I'm greedy and would love to do as much of this as I can with dynamics, I would love an explanation that tells me why that rho was high. So that's just the dynamic. Right. Yeah. So it's just entitlement. I'm not saying you can do it anyway. It's just you don't get it for free. You're sort of, you know, in the competition between explaining everything with dynamics and just assuming initial conditions, you're ceding a little bit of ground to the assumptions by just letting it be high. I would say you should explain it. Anyway, we can continue that. So the next topic is finite. So I think there's something really interesting going on, and I'll go to some slides. There's something very interesting going on that subject in this community. And what I'm going to show you now is a toy model that's actually equivalent it turns out to be totally equivalent to the little system that Alan showed in this talk. So it's an upside-down harmonic oscillator. It might not look like it, but it's an upside-down simple harmonic oscillator. It's a particle moving in this potential. And what I've put on the screen is the phase space of that physical system. And you have these trajectories, and basically in the right quadrant, you describe trajectories that roll up and roll down. Left quadrant, do it on the other side. And then up and down quadrants go flying over the top from one direction or the other. Now, this system has a tractor behavior in the informal sense, where everything gets squeezed along these axes. And it's that attractor behavior that's equivalent to the kind of attractor. In fact, it's formally equivalent, mathematically equivalent to the system that Alan showed. And so we can see that. I'm just going to focus on one quadrant. And I'm going to take a little patch. And I'm just going to evolve it with time. And there it goes. It squeezes up. It follows these phase-space trajectories and squeezes up against the axis. And we can zoom in. So I'm going to show you the little blue box. And I've just put little dots on the trajectories. And I follow them along. And as you follow it along, they move on their trajectories and get squeezed out like that. And I've quantified the squeezing by this thing. And it gets up to 100. And the squeezing, this squeezing plus is on the other axis. It's obviously not squeezed that way here. So we have this nice squeezing behavior. And the nice thing, so the concept that this illustrates is that you can have a system that has a typical behavior which is defined by the attractor. So if my cosmology were this, and then I could, then my cosmological puzzle could be, why is the universe so squeezed when there's all this phase space? Squeezed is a tiny, in some sense, a tiny part of phase space. But the answer could be, dynamically, it prefers to be squeezed. And you can do the thing that Alan described, which is, say, you take any normalizable distribution. And for all of eternity, it's squeezed. And just for a finite time, it's not. So you get this cool dynamics going on, that where this system really has this nice behavior. And I think it's that kind of behavior where the sort of isolated part of phase space is generic in a dynamical sense. And I think it's that, I think this very nicely captures the spirit of what many of us are trying to do with eternal inflation or things like that. And so this is, I think, an appealing way of thinking for many of us. Now, one of the questions I bring to this way of thinking comes from a feeling I've had since long ago as a student, that for a physicist, infinity shouldn't mean anything different from just very large. And that for a physicist, and it doesn't mean I don't get to talk about infinity if it's useful and simple and all that, but if I'm struggling with what that means, I should be able to go over to a finite but very large version of what I'm thinking, and it should be I should be able to make just as much sense of that, and that might be actually helpful. And so I'm thinking about that. But let's see. First, I'm going to just okay. So part of the original story is that that any patch will eventually squeeze, and here's another patch. So I've moved over. There was the original patch. There's another patch. It too will squeeze. As it goes off the edge, it hasn't quite achieved the quantified squeezing that I want, but it certainly is getting there. And there's no, it'll go on and get arbitrarily squeezed in a finite amount of time. So there it goes. Oh, wait a second. What happened here? Here it is again. So it turns out I lied to you, and that I actually was using a finite system. So what I actually used here was a, I was showing you part of the phase space, and what I'd actually done is write a potential. So here's the upside down harmonic oscillator, but then I added a term. I basically put a barrier here to make a finite system. So now I have a finite system to compare with. So now I want to play the game I like to play with a finite system here. So I'm sorry? 24. So that just puts the location, right? So if you look out at 24, that's where the wall is. So that gave me a window to show you without the barrier in it. So there's the potential. And so when we zoom out, we see it just going around. And we see it's interesting. It's kind of interesting what this does, because it kind of spreads out over time and all that. But that's not the main point. So the point is that in this closed system, a significant part of phase space never squeezes at all. And that remains true as you take the size to infinity. So, the phase space is still, yeah, I guess it is. Well, we can talk about the other phase space too, but this attractor behavior is changed by whatever you want. I don't want to dwell on those details, because the point is that this large region of phase space, you start your state there and it'll never squeeze significantly. It won't spend a significant fraction of its time squeeze. So and you can take the limit as much as you want. It's just different. So I don't mean this at this point in a judgmental way. It's extracting, I think, something. To believe in these kind of limiting behaviors, you really have to believe in infinity. I think it's a deep difference. I think you can't. It's not something you can duplicate in a finite system. And I think I just want to leave it at that. I also have a prejudice that makes me uncomfortable with it. But that's a more vague thing, and I think the concrete point I can make is it's something really special and pretty abstract that we're trying to do. And I also wonder, for example, when Alan put everything on a lattice on the first day of the meeting, if it isn't harming this infinite behavior by making it finite in a way equivalent to what I've done. But that's just a question. We can maybe talk later if that's really the case. And then the problem is, if you make it finite and then let it get large, that's not good enough. It's not the same kind of behavior. If the minus Q squared was I think that makes sense, but I'm not sure it changes. Do you think that changes what I'm saying? Well, I think the idea is a little. Anyway, it's on the table. We can talk more. I'd be very interested if. I mean, actually, one thing I'd love is if someone could come along with a different point of view on this limit or a different way of making it finite that would go more naturally over to the infinite case. So I'm open to having that conversation, but this is kind of putting the question on the table. So, ideas and principles. Quantum measurement. Non-ideal quantum measurements are fine with me. It's all we have. We get along just fine with that fact. And experimental errors are okay. And things unhappening are okay. Which means a measurement, the correlations get undone. It happens. It actually, you know, catch me at coffee, I'll tell you about all the ways this happens every day. So I'm just declaring my beliefs. It's just fine with me. I don't want to invent a multiverse just because I'm uncomfortable with this, because I'm not. The last point probabilities in the Born rule. I claim that every single so. We have this lifestyle where, as physicists, we can go and make measurements and analyze them very carefully with quantum theory and extract probabilities from the Born rule. And then but most of the ways we work with probabilities is much more informal. If I have a card in my pocket, you guess which one, you'll give it a flat distribution. You don't talk about a wave function. If I flip a coin, you give it an even distribution. You're not talking about the wave function. But my claim is that all those examples and every other example where we use a counting argument to come up with a probability distribution in everyday life, those are actually all Born rule probabilities. And if you flip a coin, there's amplified quantum fluctuations. So part of the story is the billiard ball story, where just a few bounces of the billiard balls and you've amplified quantum fluctuations to macroscopic scales. So this is a belief I have. We can argue about it. Many of us have been. I think I've held my ground on this so far. But I believe in everyday life, all probabilities are tracked down to physics. And since physics is quantum mechanical, so all everyday. So I believe that all of probability theory is our intuition of learning about the fact we live in a quantum world with quantum probabilities. Yeah. Right. Good. I'm glad you asked that. Yeah. So we're used to, in the formalism of quantum mechanics, we can put in non-Born rule probabilities by hand, basically, by putting in a density matrix. And so that helps me clarify. So the problem I really want to consider is, suppose I'm a cosmologist, and I have my theory of what the wave function of the universe should be. Is there anything about everyday life? So suppose I have a theory about what the wave function of the world should be. Is there anything about everyday life that I'm unable to predict? These informal probabilities about cards and coins and all that I'm unable to predict. Do I need something more than the Born rule for that? And I'm saying I don't need it. I can have it. Yeah. Right. So it is a more subtle thing I appreciate that comment. Yes. So that's what I'm really doing. And so then I claim, so I believe this to be true, and a couple of days of arguing with colleagues hasn't convinced me otherwise. And the consequence of that is that extending this intuition about probabilities, so you can just count and give even probability to all instances, to cosmology, to Hubble patches, to pocket universes, is a leap from it's a big leap from what we actually have. So I'm claiming we have intuition that's based on everyday life, that's justified by real quantum theory. And by the way, here I'm being the opposite of James. So James thinks the world is all about probability theory and people should stop screwing around with quantum theory. I believe that probability theory is just our attempts to formalize our experience with probabilities that actually come from quantum physics. So basically, things that people maybe call the zero graphic distribution, which is the probability of finding ourselves in different patches of the universe, in which Don Page showed we cannot get, well, is an extra ingredient needed to make predictions in the multiverse. That's a formal leaf. So maybe you decide you want to do it, 5-10 minutes. Maybe you decide you want to do it, but you don't get to think it's just because you're used to applying. You're used to pulling probabilities out of thin air every time you feel like it. I argue it's a giant leap. Okay, 10 minutes to go. Ergodicity. I think I'll do this just waving my hands to save time. So we have a state of the universe, as I mentioned already, that is not ergodic in some respects. If we extrapolate backwards, we do not get to use ergodic arguments to do that. Many people take that to mean that we cannot that we cannot have a theory of the universe that is ergodic. And that's blatantly wrong, because there's a simple way to do that. The simple way to do that is to have an additional, so the problem is that we'll put a couple things on the board. So, ergodicity. So, the problem is that we have a box of gas in the corner, and there's fewer microstates than if it's spread out. And so if we want to predict that it's in the corner, we can't use ergodicity. But if the system is part of a larger system, and the correlations in phase space are such that the larger system is ergodic and allows for this to happen, for example, by pumping on the box, then it's easy enough for the larger system to be ergodic, and you're just looking at a small part that's behaving very differently due to its interactions with the larger system, despite the fact that that's not ergodic for its own internal degrees of freedom. Now, you could worry that the case of pumping on a box of gas doesn't seem to be a closed system, but I can give really simple examples. For example, anytime you bring two thermodynamic systems into contact, the fluctuations of each of them changes, usually in a pretty subtle way, but they change. For example, if I have one box of gas, totally isolated, it has a fixed energy. The energy cannot fluctuate at all. If I bring a second box of gas into contact with it, the energy of the first box is able to fluctuate. And it's not non-ergodic. It's ergodic for the larger system and not ergodic for the smaller. So there's no question that you can have an ergodic theory of the universe. You just have to work out what the extra degrees of freedom are and understand if the correlations, the interactions between the universe and those are appropriate to make the universe as we see it. Right. So in that kind of story, the larger system. So that's getting back. So if I want to completely free myself from dependence on assumptions about the initial conditions, I might be tempted to exploit the equilibrium exemption. And say I have a system in equilibrium and I never have to say anything about initial conditions. Probabilities, if I know the Hamiltonian, I can assign probabilities to every state, and that's it. And I done wondering about initial conditions altogether. And that would be to have it ergodic. That's a very appealing picture to me, and now I'm going to tell you about my attempts to think that way about the universe. I just have a few minutes left. So the ideas, I take various ideas from ideas about lambda, holography, to construct a finite cosmology. That's another thing I'm working on, is thinking about finiteness. And I build in the equilibrium idea, and I see this as a counterpoint to the infinities of eternal inflation, something to try to do something different, and I unabashedly exploit. So there's no question that I'm BSing about certain uncertainties in fundamental physical laws, but I think everyone is. So I don't think that differentiates me from anyone else in this room, but I'm doing it differently, and so there's more sense of resistance, and there's some papers to look at. So the basic idea is to think that lambda is truly fundamental and take the cues, as a number of other people have, that this could imply an actual finiteness of the system. There's a finite maximum entropy. This can be related to a finite number of states. And so I think of this just as a finite system sitting there in equilibrium and fluctuating. And you take cues, other people, especially Banks and Fischler and Lenny to some degree, have thought about this possibility of a finite, this implying a truly finite dimensional Hilbert space, and I exploit that. So as we discussed earlier in the talk, we can think about an equilibrium system having an arrow of time temporarily due to some fluctuation, and I've shown you here how the arrow of time is double-headed. The minimum entropy, the arrow of time goes away from the minimum entropy state. This is known to have a Boltzmann-Brain problem, and I'll come back to that. And then the realization of this idea in my picture is that the equilibrium is the de Sitter space, and the rare fluctuation is some, you imagine you have an inflaton, and it's able to tunnel up the potential. The fluctuation I consider is driven by the Guse-Fahrenheit process, and that leads to a particular form, particular thing you can calculate for that fluctuation. And the key driver of that rate is the seed mass that you start with to tunnel up the potential. And for typical inflaton potentials that are at the gut scale, the seed mass you need is a gram. So the minimum seed mass is a gram. And so this is where I argue we've actually evaded Boltzmann-Brain problems, because as long as you believe brains have to be more than a gram, you're better off producing a whole inflationary universe than just one brain. And also, as we were talking over dinner last night, if you believe that Minkowski space can have Boltzmann-Brains, that's a serious problem in a lot of theories. I think, open for discussion whether that's the case, but this does not have Minkowski space, and therefore does not have a Minkowski space Boltzmann-Brain problem. The Guse-Fahrenheit process has been subject to a lot of skepticism of various sorts, most of it rather indirect. I think the most direct skepticism comes from the idea that it has a very strange seed mass goes to zero limit. But Andrew Alvestad and I have recently showed that limit was an artifact of the thin wall approximation that was used to get that limit. And that's just simply not a problem. That problem is not real for that process. And we can discuss what else there might be. So here's a cartoon of what I'm imagining happens. You have this de Sitter equilibrium on the left. The tunneling happens. A few degrees of freedom decouple for a while to make inflation. You tunnel to an inflating state behind a horizon in the Guse-Fahrenheit process. That inflates, gives me the entire Big Bang. But when you return to de Sitter, you have you just have a finite number of degrees of freedom. At some point, they have to recouple. You can't. They are coupled, and they recouple, and they actually recouple in the lifetime of the universe, which is just the time scale for the de Sitter equilibrium. And there's interesting, because it's finite, this looks a lot like work by Carroll and Chen, but because it's finite, there's some important differences. The implications are you get recurrences, you're in equilibrium, and there is necessarily a breakdown of continuum field theory at some point because you have a finite Hilbert space. So the last point to make is how that what I think happens with that breakdown. This is a picture of the density of the universe. There's inflation, there's radiation era, matter era, and so on, and lambda era at the end. And I can make a plot like this with the Hubble length, which just involves really flipping that curve over. There's all the ingredients sitting in there. And then this has the history of the universe. So there's the inflationary period at the beginning. There's the end of inflation, reheating, weak scale, BBN today, and everything. And we can follow co-moving scales that exit during inflation and enter today. And there's a range of scales of interest. So looking at the de Sitter era, there's an interesting behavior of the past horizon. So if we look at the largest region we can see in the past at any observational event in the de Sitter era, it takes this finite form. That's because there's an event horizon in the de Sitter space. And so we have a certain amount of inflation that fills that de Sitter space, but this amount of inflation overfills it. And so I conjecture that the way effective field theory breaks down, the continuum field theory breaks down in this model, is to reject, say we can only fill up one de Sitter volume, because that's all there is. There's one, ultimately there's just one de Sitter volume in this picture. And we actually argue, when you look at the Bluth-Fire process, that you saturate that bound. And here's the here's how different inflation models meet that bound. So here's the past horizon. You can have low scale, high scale inflation, and they're all unified together by needing to start inflation on the past horizon. And it's interesting, and so here's a variety of inflation models, and the physics of what happens here, which we think we know, translates into a fixed number of E-foldings, because this is the physics, plus the scale of inflation tells us how many E-foldings we have. And Dan Phillips and I just worked out that this, with up to factors of order one, ends up being the same bound on E-foldings that Banks and Fischler came up with using holographic arguments. So there's something very similar about the different arguments. Last minute, I'm going to talk about cosmic curvature. Guthfari tunnels through a bubble. There'll be curvature in the bubble. The finite amount of inflation dilutes the curvature, but not arbitrarily large. It's interesting that you can put the curvature scale, because the past horizon scales as A when it's outside of the Hubble length. The curvature also scales as A, the curvature radius. And so these two curves travel in parallel, and the initial bubble, the omega that comes from the initial bubble, omega curvature, just tells us the gap between these two curves. Once you know that gap, the information is just translated in a simple way all the way up to today. And so we can calculate omega curvature today just by looking at this limiting behavior, which actually, it only depends in the end on the initial bubble, which gives that gap, and then the shape of this, how the past horizon curls over here. And that just depends on this simple ratio of observable quantities. So you get an answer, and you get a prediction where you're predicting curvature just based on observable quantities in the initial bubble. But you get a result that's consistent with observations today, but just. And so it's a very exciting thing that you can take these admittedly very speculative ideas and point to something to measure that could inform us about this way of thinking. So to conclude, the search for the big picture of the universe is certainly challenging, but it's really fun. I think this conference shows how interesting and exciting it is. And I think despite sort of how skeptical you might get about, we're being pretty wild and reaching pretty far, but the fact is we can do science with the universe, so I think we should be hopeful. And we should actually try to, there's a reason we should be trying to succeed at this. It appears that there's something right about inflation in cosmology, and so I think we should try to see what kind of fundamental physics can make inflation actually work And the de Sitter equilibrium, I think, it's a finite alternative and gives us something to balance what I think are really extravagant infinities of the eternal inflation picture and infinities that I think are fundamentally problematic for that story. And it's really fun to actually have made some observable predictions. Thanks.
I'm the only person.